ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our special lunchtime event. And today we're very fortunate to have two very distinguished speakers from Hong Kong, Anson Chen and Martin Lee. We're going to talk about a very important topic, the future of Hong Kong under the formula of one country, two system. And as we know, dramatic social, economic, political events are unfolding in Hong Kong. In 2014, we saw the dramatic protest of young people against Beijing's proposed electoral reform, and a protest evolved into a month-long demonstration against the central government as well as the government in Hong Kong. And also in the recent election, and we saw some fatty, for want of a better description, more radical and pro-independence legislator elected. So it's something quite dramatic in Hong Kong. And also we can sense the frustration amongst a lot of young people over a range of issues about political system in Hong Kong and the kind of encroachment, I suppose, of the Chinese government in the Hong Kong's way of life. And we're also seeing a social inequality, the widening gap, and the skyrocketing house prices and economic opportunities. So there's a wide range of issues that the people are unhappy about and are frustrated. And so we have two very distinguished speakers here to talk about this issue. And before I will start, I want to note that throughout our institute's history, and we have taken a heterodox approach to the way we look at the world. We are host to the widest range of opinions, but we're not an advocate of any of them. And we are proud to have encouraged a diverse range of opinions about China among some of our most eminent and prominent policymakers, scholars, and commentators like Anson and Martin. And so we wanted to help our country to have a national conversation about things. We're doing that today. So I think the format of today's lunchtime event will be, I will let Anson and Martin to make some opening remark about their take on the situation in Hong Kong. Then we're going to have a Q&A session and straight after their remarks. So first, let me introduce Martin. Martin was the founding chairman of Hong Kong Democratic Party and a long-standing legislator. He's often regarded as the father of Hong Kong's democracy movement. He's the winner of numerous international human rights awards, including the 1995 International Human Rights Award of the American Bar Association. He's a senior Hong Kong barrister and was on the Chinese committee which drafted Hong Kong's constitutional basic law until he had to leave this committee after he protested against the Tiananmen Square massacre. He has a long history of advocacy for Hong Kong's freedom as promised in the 1984 Sino-British Joint Declaration, in specific conformity with the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. He argues that because the declaration is registered with the United Nations, the party compliance with the declaration is of a proper international concern. And also I would like to introduce Anson as well. Anson was the first Chinese and also the first woman to assume the post of a chief secretary and head of a civil service under the British sovereignty in Hong Kong. And she was the international symbol for continuity when she remained in the post as the first chief secretary for the administration after Hong Kong's transition to the Chinese sovereignty in 1997. And she was thus the second in command of Hong Kong to both Chris Patten, the last British governor, and as well as to C.H. Tong, the first Chinese chief executive. She was then sometime described as the most powerful woman in Asia. She oversaw many infrastructure developments, including Hong Kong's new iconic airport. During her early years in the civil service, she successfully led a campaign for equal pay and condition for women. And after her retirement from the civil service, she was elected to the Hong Kong's Legislative Council. She is now active in promoting principle of good governance and democracy in Hong Kong and defending one country, two system, Hong Kong people ruling Hong Kong. And in 1997, may I add, she felt confident in reassuring the world that Hong Kong's way of life and commercial sanctity would continue. She now sees threats, which she is here to discuss. She has been a strong defender of Hong Kong's free press, is a former trustee of Reuters, and she's a convener of Hong Kong's 2020 and is the funding director of a Project Citizens Foundation. And this bio, why, is a very abbreviated and the bio of them. And so without Martin Hart first.
Well, actually, it was Ensign who said that I should start first. She served as chief secretary of Munition under Chris Patton. Chris Patton listened to her, and that's why Chris Patton is still very fondly remembered in Hong Kong. She then served C.H. Tong, the first chief executive of Hong Kong. C.H. Tong didn't listen to her. She resigned. So when she asked me to go first, I go first. Now, this policy of one country, two systems, Hong Kong people ruling Hong Kong, was thought to be Deng Xiaoping's brainchild. And when he came up with this policy, a lot of people thought that that was only because of Hong Kong, Macau, and Taiwan, and what he wanted to have sovereignty over all these. So he came up with this policy. But I later began to think it wasn't just for these three, but actually for China. If you think about it, why would communist country like China allow these three territories, Hong Kong, Macau, and Taiwan, to practice capitalism when the rest of China practiced communism or socialism? Clearly, one way you look at it is, well, China wanted to entice the people of these three territories to come back, just as the communists enticed the Shanghainese business people to stay with the country, to stay with the government in Hong Kong and other places, and then take over in every part. Okay, there are logical ways of thinking about these things. But in Hong Kong, we were not given the option of independence by Britain. In fact, the British government already decided not to give independence to Hong Kong as early as 1972. Because on the 8th of March, 1970, Great Britain, at the objection of China, which just gained admission into the United Nations, took out Hong Kong from her list of colonies. Because in that year, all the countries in the world asked to submit a list of colonies to the nations. Hong Kong was not on the list of colonies government. That means Hong Kong would have friendly. We didn't know that at the time. We only came to know about later on. So when Deng Xiaoping wanted to have back, Margaret Thatcher had. But when the two of them sat down in Beijing at a very important meeting on the 19th of April in Beijing, right after they issued the Sino-British Joint Declaration, there was a British minute of that meeting, which was disclosed to the public after 30 years in December 2014. And that document, in fact, contains something very interesting. Deng Xiaoping was explaining to Margaret Thatcher that she had nothing to worry about Hong Kong, because it was China's own policy to rule Hong Kong under the policy of one country, two systems, Hong Kong degree of autonomy, so that China could develop economically until China would be at par with the other countries on economic terms. And he went on to say, at the end of the period, the less reason you have to worry about Hong Kong, because by then, we, the leading economists of the world, would be depending. What did he mean? I thought at the time, but without any evidence, that China, that Deng Xiaoping already wanted to go down the capitalist road instead of sticking with the socialist road. He must have looked at Hong Kong, seeing Hong Kong as a vibrant economy of a Chinese community, with the rule of law, with freedoms, with a level playing field, and he wanted China to have that. He must have already made it in the early 1980s when he opened up for overseas investments, that would be the destiny. And he wanted Hong Kong to be a successful example and the engine to lead China forward in terms of modernization. At that time, China had four modernization programs, and Hong Kong, obviously, was to be the engine leading China. Great idea, if you come to think of it. Today, in China, it doesn't practice socialism, capitalism, but of course, with a certain degree, a high degree of state control, whenever necessary. Deng Xiaoping did that without even mentioning the word capitalism. He can't do that. So he called it socialism with Chinese characteristics, just did it. So Hong Kong was beacon. It's meant to be the beacon. Then came the Tiananmen Massacre, 1989. The Communist Party was under threat of being toppled. And so he resorted to drastic measures in controlling the student movement. But he actually doubled up the pace of inflation as far as the economy was concerned. If you look at China today, it's the world's second largest economy. So it was immensely successful. Hong Kong's GDP contribution to China is about much smaller. So, if you look at Hong Kong today, how is Hong Kong being administered as a special administrative region? You see the Communist Party in control of Hong Kong. They are all housed in a building somewhere in the western part of, called the Central Government Liaison Office. It was making all major decisions for and on behalf of the Hong Kong. And our chief executive, C.H. Tung, simply implements everything to do. He himself is an underground Communist Party card, but of course he will not acknowledge it. So that is why Hong Kong is now in a... Because in spite of the blueprint of Deng Xiaoping, the Communist Party in Hong Kong, blueprint for 19 years. And so Hong Kong is in a very terrible state. And Anson will give you more details as to what Hong Kong is today. And if Hong Kong were to continue like this, we are finished. The financial center, I can tell you that. Because without democracy, without the vote, the government will not be answerable to the people it governs. The government would be listening to Beijing all the time, listening to the wrong people, the communists who are now in Hong Kong, in the liaison office, and they just want to control Hong Kong, right? Which is the exact opposite of what Deng Xiaoping had in mind. How can Hong Kong be masters of their own house? How can, when they don't even elect their leader and all the members of the legislature? But these were promises already contained in the Basic Law. The Basic Law says very plainly that the ultimate aim is for there to be universal suffrage, whereby the Hong Kong people would democratically elect not only the chief executive, but all members of the legislature. In other words, Beijing must trust the Hong Kong people. But for 19 years now, although the members of the legislature from the democratic side have consistently won more votes than their opponents, the pro-Beijing parties, consistently. They were completely ignored by Beijing. That's wrong. Something is terribly wrong. But what to do in the future? Now, ladies and gentlemen, I suggest that not only Hong Kong is at a crossroads, China too. Because at the moment, Xi Jinping has been hitting the corrupt officials in China very hard, much harder than it was safe for himself. So there were reports that there were attempts at his life on a couple of occasions, but unsuccessfully, obviously. If you are one of the corrupt tigers of China, would you sit there patiently and wait for the people to arrest you? Of course not. Of course you gang up together and try to stop Xi Jinping from doing whatever to the country. So Xi Jinping to fight from within the party. How do I know, I'm often asked, that this guy means well? Well, I can't prove it to you. But I think practically all the people outside of China think that he is a dictator. He is fast grabbing more power to himself, setting up high-powered committees, one after the other in China, and he chairing all of them. But if I ask you to think a little further, why would he reduce the membership or the number of members of the most important group in China, among the leadership, from 7 to 5? Why? Because obviously he thought he had difficulty in controlling the 7. Arithmetic. He reduced it to 5, clearly would have 3 votes out of the 5, that's good enough. 3 votes out of 7, no good. That is a simple way of showing that he hasn't got the power that he wants. But does he want absolute power in order to be a dictator? One possibility, distinct possibility. Or, as I hope, that when he's got enough power, introduce reforms to China, which would be wonderful news indeed. Because from the point of view of the overseas, of the international, it must be sheer joy for every government to be able to deal with a democratically elected government. And so it must be in the interest of every government in the world to bring about democracy. But where better to begin? Hong Kong. And that is what the Chinese leaders were prepared to do when they allowed the Basic Law to be drafted in this way, promising the Hong Kong people, yes, for the first 10 years, you guys must wait. But at the end of the 10th year, you could have. That is a clear promise in our constitution. And China has been reneging for years now. So we in Hong Kong will continue. We are fighting for democracy within a cage. The cage is the one country, two systems. But there is no reason why we cannot hold the Chinese government to all these promises, not only contained in our Basic Law, but also in the Sino-British International Treaty. And so the rest of the world, I hope, would look at the matter in the same way that Deng Xiaoping looked at it and demand an explanation, a promise from the Chinese at every level. Why don't you deliver? You promised Hong Kong and in the international community that Hong Kong would be given universal suffrage so the people can be masters of their own house. When are you going to? Why have you not already done? I look at Hong Kong positively. I look at China positively. For that, I'm called a traitor. I don't mind it, because I know I'm doing the right thing. Deng Xiaoping wanted this policy to be implemented for Hong Kong, Macau, and Taiwan, and most important of all, China. That's the way he wanted China to go. Unlike Russia, sticking with us, he wanted China to go down the road of capitalism. But of course, not just capitalism. There have to be other parts which work well with capitalism, like freedoms, like freedom, press freedom, human rights, the rule of law, independence of the judiciary. You need all that as a package. And you cannot go without any one of them. And Hong Kong is the shining example of having all these things, except democracy. So I suggest the way forward, not only for Hong Kong, but for China, is go back to Deng Xiaoping's blueprint and let that glorious dream of be realized. It is more difficult to realize a dream than to come up with a dream, because a dream will come to you without knowing about it, and to implement it requires conviction, self-confidence, wisdom. I hope Ben can show us that he is, and that he will bring China forward, had hoped as we had hoped. Thank you.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, thank you all for being. Next year, we face two very important events. First, the election of executive, and secondly, celebration, or it ought to be celebration, of the 20th anniversary after Hang China. I have to say that at the moment, the predominant mood in Hong Kong is neither event gives us much cause. Why? First, our chief executive will continue to be elected by a very small circle election committee comprising exactly 1,200 out of a potentially qualified electorate of 5.4 million people. So neither Martin nor myself have the ability to elect our chief executive. Furthermore, of this 1,200, probably about 900 are entirely in the pockets of Beijing and will do exactly what they are told. So the candidates will, as on previous occasions, be anointed by China and will then be elected by the 1,200. What we hope for is that the pan-democratic camp will at least amongst this 1,200 garner a certain number of votes to be able to at least to some extent influence the outcome. The mood at the moment is that because the present incumbent, Mr. C.Y. Leung, is so highly unpopular, there is now a well-known slogan in Hong Kong called ABC, which is anybody but C.Y. Leung. That doesn't say very much in terms of the suitability, the standing, and the credibility of the next chief executive. But I think that if Beijing denies C.Y. Leung a second term, then at the very least, we can look perhaps forward to better governance. The second, the 20th anniversary after Hong Kong's handover, we should have been able to celebrate the faithful and successful implementation of One Country, Two Systems. And the cornerstone of One Country, Two Systems revolves around the rule of law, protection of basic rights and freedoms, a high standard of probity within the civil service, transparency, accountability, and level playing field. Instead, what are we seeing happening in Hong Kong? Now, in the colonial days, and for 156 years, Hong Kong was governed by the British. The Queen, who appointed all the governors, was affectionately known as the proprietress. After the handover, for a short period, China was also affectionately regarded as the grandfather, indulgent, benevolent. The difference between the two is this. The proprietress was quite happy to leave Hong Kong alone, so long as Hong Kong was making money for it. But the grandfather, with the passage of time, has become increasingly autocratic, increasingly determined to have her way with Hong Kong, and increasingly attempting to rewrite the basic law and the guarantees contained in the basic law. And the basic law, in turn, was based on the joint declaration which Great Britain and China signed in 1904. The evidence for this is 2 years ago, the State Council issued a white paper in which it made it quite clear that what little autonomy Hong Kong enjoys is for China to give and take away at. It went on furthermore, to our great consternation and concern, to point out that members of the judiciary are part of the administration, and as such, have to have regard when they sit in court making judgments to national security and development interests. This is directly contrary to the rule of law and to the independence of the Hong Kong courts. Just to give you a flavor of why we are so concerned. If you look at the main indicators of freedom, of particular importance to Hong Kong people, our lifestyle, our core values. First of all, various freedoms. And most basic is freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, freedom of the press, academic freedom. The press today, in the eyes of the Hong Kong people, confidence in the press has fallen to a 10-year low. And if you measure it by the World Freedom Index compiled by Reporters Without Frontiers, we have fallen from number 18 in the year 2002 to number 69 index. We have seen and continue to see increasing self-censorship. We have seen reporters being attacked, one or two very viciously. We have seen dismissal of popular talk show hosts and columnists because they dare to say and write about things that either the SAR government or Beijing do not wish to listen or to hear. So certainly press freedom is under threat, and this affects not just the ordinary men in the street, but it also affects the overall business environment, because business people want to have free flow of information in order to make the proper business decisions. But if the press is going to be gagged, and if no truth can be uttered by the press, then very soon the business sector will find that they don't have available the most accurate, most up-to-date information in order to make business decisions for them. Secondly, judicial independence. Well, Martin have more direct experience of the courts, and he will say to you that at least today, by and large, the courts still remain very. That may be the case. But if all the other freedoms fall, then I dare say even the independence of the jury will not last very long. A particular incident has caused us very, very great concern, not just amongst the local people, but amongst the expatriate business people, including Australian businessmen living and working in Hong Kong. And you may have read about it, and that is about the case of book publishers being abducted. Of these five book publishers, one book publisher, Mr. Lee Bo, held a British passport. He was definitely abducted from Hong Kong soil. Mr. Gui Minghai admittedly was not abducted in Hong Kong, but in Thailand. He held a Swiss passport. But in the eyes of the Chinese, once you are born a Chinese, you are forever a Chinese, unless you go through the rigmarole and the formalities of official renunciation. Otherwise, you are always a Chinese national. In other words, they can have their way with you, irrespective of whatever foreign passports you hold. Now, this particular case raises a very basic freedom, and that is freedom of the courts and independence of the judiciary. The abduction of Mr. Lee Po is evidently the exercise of extrajudicial powers on Hong Kong soil. Up to this particular incident, at least Hong Kong people felt, with other values and freedoms being undermined all around us, at least whilst we are in Hong Kong, so long as we do not break Hong Kong laws, we're safe enough in our own. But what this particular incident demonstrates forcefully to all of us is that even that can no longer be assumed. Because if you are involved in a political tussle or you're involved in a business dispute, you could equally be made to disappear from Hong Kong soil by some strong-arm agent within it. Third, as you know, the Chinese places a very high premium on education, on quality education, education that encourages free thinking, that develops your critical thinking faculty, and that allows you to discuss within the school confines or within the university anything you wish to discuss under the sun. But we have seen gross political interference in our alma mater, Martin and my, the Hong Kong University. Hong Kong University is the oldest university in Hong Kong. In my days, it was the only university in Hong Kong. And it has traditionally and continues to provide some of the leading members of our professions, our business and industry. And that is why we are so concerned at any interference to interfere in the internal administration of the university, its institutional autonomy and academic. And this particular case, you will find it very odd, was targeted against an individual, Professor Ioannis Chen, who was head of the dean, who was the dean of the law faculty. He is actually a member of my little think tank, Hong Kong 20. He is a very moderate person. He's hardly a radical, hardly an activist. But he was the teacher of Mr. Benny Tai, who was one of the three architects of the Occupy Central, which subsequently led to the umbrella movement. And that was his only sin. Just to give you a flavor of the far reach of the Communist Party's propaganda machinery and United Front tactic, the left-wing press, within a period of several weeks, orchestrated a smear campaign against Ioannis, wrote something like 350 articles in the left-wing press denigrating Ioannis. Consequently, although the university selection committee had decided to appoint him to a pro-vice chancellor post, the university eventually, on various pretexts, decided he was not suitable. So much for press freedom, for academic freedom. In our view, if Hong Kong University, then all the other seven universities will fall in rapid succession. This is what has given rise to the youth movement, because young people are particularly angry, particularly frustrated and disaffected, not only at the failure of the government to come to grips with a whole host of social and livelihood problems, but fundamentally because they see a steady chipping away at one country, two systems, Hong Kong's culture, Hong Kong's lifestyle, and Hong Kong's core values. At least the election to the Legislative Council on 4th of September gives us some hope, because we have a generation of young legislators. Yes, you will have to give them time to learn from their mistakes, but I admire them for their courage, because they have done so at considerable price to their own future. People like Joshua Wong, who spearheaded the campaign against the introduction of brainwashing national education curriculum, he makes it virtually very difficult for him when he graduates from university to find a job. But nevertheless, he and his colleagues have the courage to stand up and be counted. And I think Hong Kong's future lies with this generation. What is the way forward? If China wishes to see stability and continuing prosperity in Hong Kong, all they need to do is to revert to Deng Xiaoping's visionary concept of one country, two systems. If you turn Hong Kong into another Chinese city, I can guarantee you that Hong Kong will be marginalized very, very quickly. It is because we have the software of rule of law, basic rights and freedoms, transparency and level playing field, that we stand apart from any other Chinese city. And that is why we remain China's preeminent financial endeavor. If we willingly give up on these distinctions, then we no longer have a role to play in the overall growth of China as a whole. I think despite China now becoming an economic powerhouse, it still has need for Hong Kong. And I think the rest of the world, Australia and any other country, I can understand that every country wishes to trade with China, wishes to attract Chinese men. But do bear in mind that trade and investment is not a one-way street, where both parties stand to benefit. And the way to influence China to become a responsible international is for the West, is for democratic countries to stand firmly and consistently on your principles and on your values. Thank you.
I think we can all agree it was a very insightful presentation. We only have about 15 minutes, so I think I'm going to give everyone a chance to ask questions. So do take us. Can you just please briefly state your name and affiliation?
Thank you. Pete Bannister. I'm a retired government economist consulting to the Ministry of Transportation in Beijing. And my project involves an additional high-speed railway between Beijing and Tianjin, but it has been announced that it would be good if it were privately financed. In my advice, I've been looking for a jurisdiction in which disputes could be arbitrated. And I could think of a couple. Hong Kong was one. I couldn't think of another really obvious one. Singapore may have been acceptable to the government, perhaps, the Chinese government. The problem is to find one that is acceptable to Western consortia with Western financiers. I'd really like to hear your comments on it, and that's enough. Thank you.
Just with the future question, can you please keep it brief, because we don't have a lot of time. Anson, do you want to take that
question?
In the early 1980s, I was invited as a group to go to Beijing and to talk with them about arbitration in China. And the responsible officer, who later became the Chief Justice of China, told me very proudly that arbitration in China is being taken very seriously, that they have been very fair and have gained overseas recognition. Gave me four examples that in one case, Chinese entity won 100%. In the second case, the Chinese entity lost 100%. In the other two cases, it's half and half. Am I right that the one that China won 100% was much bigger than the one that China lost 100%? He said, how do you know? Now, that is the problem. Now Xi Jinping is coming up with this idea, this grandiose idea of one belt, one road. Obviously, there would have to be. Yes, there has to be resolution of disputes, right? And Hong Kong is only the Chinese city which can boast of a rule of law, judiciary. But as Anson told you about the white paper published, and that's frightening. So I think China must recognize that. And if Xi Jinping is serious about One Belt, One Road, he must make sure that Hong Kong will regain everything it might have lost in terms of the rule of law, judiciary. China must make a U-turn too there. Otherwise, nobody is interested.
Thank you. My name's Paul Marich. I'm working financial services here. I used to live in Hong Kong and still a permanent resident, which I'm proud of for Hong Kong. My question, if we go back to 1997 and we said, well, one country, two systems, over 50 years, and if we were optimistic, we'd say in 50 years' time or during that period, China is going to be a whole lot more like Hong Kong than it is today. And certainly from the capitalist side and the wealth of people in China, it is. But we haven't seen the reforms that we might have expected in China in terms of a towards more democracy, really at any level. Martin, when you spoke, you sounded optimistic, a little bit optimistic, that that might still come. So I'm wondering what's fueling that optimism.
Can you continue to suppress everybody in China and even in Hong Kong and Macau and hope the Taiwanese would like to come back to you? Because I think for the last 10 years, for the last 15 years, before Xi took over, the Chinese leaders had more or less given up Taiwan. But so long as you don't talk about independence, you can't even talk about it. If you continue to enjoy your de facto independence, okay, but don't say the dirty word I, all right? Otherwise, we have all our missiles at least turned in your direction. Now, he knows that Xi Jinping wants Taiwan. If he wants Taiwan, he must do something good to Hong Kong. Otherwise, interested at all. And also, how does he want to bring China forward? Think. It's a big problem for him. All right. Now, of course, ideally, the GDP in China can grow and grow and grow. Know that when they say 7%, it is always 7%. If it's 6.9%, always 6.9%. So yes. And people are talking about a possible the bubble being burst. Right? Now, so he knows that all these problems, no doubt he wants the Communist Party to China. But obviously he's looking at Singapore. They like the Singapore model because you have the semblance of them so that they know exactly how many seats they're going to win even before the first vote cast. They regularly lose two seats every time so that when the American congressmen go to Singapore, they won't see a one-party state. And they pick the two candidates from the other parties who would win. And always also the semblance democracy and the rule of law too. The rule of law, every case the government is involved, the government wins. Even ex-ministers. I asked my friends there, how do they do it? Very simple. They give the most experienced judge to try these cases. Experienced judge, that's good, isn't it? No. Because it's the most experienced judge, oldest, and is the oldest, is well past retirement. So his term of office is continued from year to year. All right? So they like that. But at least, it's much better than the Chinese system now. Right? So I think Xi Jinping knows all these. I think he's got a plan. I think something has to be done very quickly before the next chief executive is chosen It's either CY Leung or ABC. If it is CY Leung, Hong Kong is finished. If it's ABC, maybe. We still have to see whether he's going to bring Hong Kong back to the direction laid down in the blueprint. Making a big container turn 180 degrees is very, very difficult. So it needs a lot of willpower in Xi Jinping.
Any more questions? Yes, Hannah?
Hi, I'm Hannah Worth with the Institute. I wondered if you could comment on where you think the role of the UK or United Kingdom is, given that they are the other half of the signatory of... I mean, do you think that they have a responsibility to Sensible, given that they've also had this golden age of...
Definitely. I think we've been at pains on every occasion possible to point out that Britain has both a moral and legal obligation to Hong Kong, to the Joint Declaration. What Britain would like to, you know, pretend is that it is a Chinese declaration. It is a declaration made in good faith at that time by two sovereign powers, that is Great Britain and China. I have to say that for many years we've been disappointed with Britain's performance, particularly given what is happening in Hong Kong. They still are required to write 6 monthly reports on how the Joint Declaration is being in Hong Kong. And until very recently, these reports have become more and more pro forma and more bland. Until two things happened. The Foreign Affairs Committee, members of the Foreign Affairs Committee of Parliament, wanted to come to Hong Kong to see for themselves, 30 years after the signature of the Joint Declaration, how well the Joint Declaration was being implemented.
After our visit there.
And I'm sure at the Chinese behest, or at least the very least, the decision of the chief executive, Hong Kong refused to grant these members this. So that was a direct public slap, which prompted the Foreign Affairs Committee, naturally, to get very, very angry. And then the very recent book publisher case prompted the Foreign Secretary to stand up and say this is a serious breach of the Joint Declaration. Yes, David Cameron and George Osborne, you know, touted the beginning of the golden era between Great Britain and China. Well, I think under Theresa May, maybe the golden era still has to come. I think Theresa May probably takes a more cautious outlook, about China's behavior. George Osborne, from what I hear from his colleagues, likes to think he is the world's expert on how to deal with China. I think we have more direct experience and other people have more direct experience. And if there's one thing I'm certain is that if you roll over and pull your punch, you do not earn China's respect. They will negotiate seriously with you if they think the other party negotiates from strength, not from a position of weakness. They may not say this to your face, but they will have grudging for you if you hold fast to your principles and to your values.
Golden era. It reminded me of the 30 pieces of silver turning gold. We met the Attorney General and then the Foreign Affairs Minister Bishop. We had very sympathetic hearings. We also met the committee, which is called the
Joint
Committee. They were quite knowledgeable, very enthusiastic, and good questions. And also the representatives of the Green Party and the Labour Party. I urged them to have a bipartisan policy on Hong Kong. Why not? They might have differences on China, South China Sea, all that. But clearly, there cannot be any difference on Hong Kong.
I think your government officials are aware of what's happening in Hong Kong. They readily agree that Australia has a huge, as you have 90,000 of your nationals living there. Your largest offshore chamber is in Hong Kong, and you have huge investments and trade. If something seriously goes wrong with Hong Kong, then your government will be faced with the prospect of having to repatriate 90,000 people. So you don't want to see that happen.
Question here?
I just have a question about the election of the pro-independence members of EGCO. Up until a couple of years ago, I didn't hear much talk about independence movement in Hong Kong. It was about making one country, two systems work. But I think with the failure of China to adhere to one country, two systems, they're now getting a more radical approach. So I have two questions. One, what do you think of the success or the buy-in by the Hong Kong population on the pro-independence candidates? And secondly, what do you think the reaction of China will be to their election? Thank you.
I think the general public, the majority of Hong Kong people, do not believe that independence is an option. Whether you look at it from the economic point of view, the social or the political point, okay? Secondly, I would point out that in fact, it's only a very small minority of people support independence, and then maybe even half seriously. They're doing so out of sheer frustration and growing anger, as you say, at the fate of China to honor its promises to the Hong Kong. But they probably also know in their hearts that it's just not viable. Okay? And the fact that the electorate feels able to elect them simply feels that there should be different voices, yes, and also maybe to indicate to the government their extreme discontent. The outcome of the September 4th election is very contrary to what the chief executive wanted. When he last spoke in the Legislative Council, he told voters with the upcoming election, vote out the pan-democrats, vote out particularly those who filibuster. Look at the outcome. The outcome is exactly the opposite of what he wanted to see. Martin will answer the second part.
Of course, the leaders in Beijing don't want to hear the word independence. And if those advocating for independence of Hong Kong were to win the Legislative Council, what would the people in Taiwan think? You know, they always think into that. But I think basically they know what's happening. They know these young people who talk about independence and even revolution don't mean it. Throughout history, there have been many, many successful and many more unsuccessful revolutions. But you never find anybody talking about revolution. You talk about it, you do it quietly, right? See, you might not succeed. But our young people, they talk about revolution in order to do what? In order to gain a seat in the Legislative Council, which they vow to overthrow. So, I mean, they know they are not serious. I'm sure the leaders in Beijing, they are no fools. They know they are not serious. And once they got elected, they don't talk about it anymore. What can they do? Right? So nobody really takes them seriously. But and they got elected. Yes, there were some young voters who got very frustrated because of the breaking of promises by Beijing, right? And looking at the way that the Hong Kong government is now controlled by the party. So out of frustration, they would say these things. But basically, what they want is the seats. And the Hong Kong people, this time it's very strange. They don't actually know some of these candidates. Some of these young candidates don't belong to any well-established party at all. They form a party, call it by a strange-sounding name, but claim to be Democrat. And then when the public opinion poll published 2 days before the election showed that these people have a chance of success, then there was this guy, Benjamin Benny Tai, who actually thought about this Occupy Central for the first guy. And he then sent messages to certain group of supporters to vote for these pro-democracy candidates who have a chance to win. And they must spread the votes, share the votes, all right, get both of them in. And people didn't know about these people. They don't know what were the names. I still don't know some of their names. But people just voted for them. So not because of their campaign platform, independence or whatever, but because they are Democrats, they believe in our values, and they have a chance of success. And so a lot of youngsters got elected like this, right? So I don't think Beijing really worries. But they don't want to hear the word.
Saying, as the MC, I'm probably going to abuse my privilege. I'm going to ask the last question. And I'm about the religion.
Since actually, very gentlemanly. Normally the guy who sits up there asks the first question.
And thank you for that. And you mentioned you're Roman Catholics, and in Hong Kong, some of the most vocal critiques of Beijing Catholics, including the former Cardinal Archbishop Kong. And now there's a talk that the Vatican is going to have a reapproach Beijing. and what impact do you think it would have any on, you know, the kind of Beijing? And then, Stan, Anson, you went to a Catholic convent school as well?
I'm a Catholic too.
Oh, yes. So the kind of questions that actually for both of you, how would you feel about this rapprochement if it's going to have any impact on the way you look at it?
Now, I'm a very good friend of Cardinal Zen. He and the Vatican don't think alike, because he has always been concerned about the Catholics in the Church, many of whom have been sent to prison many years, including priests and bishops. And he believes that any agreement with China would have to be done very carefully. Originally, they had some understanding about the appointment of bishops. Then China reneged again. So he is extremely suspicious, like the Vatican, to think more carefully before it can be reached. But the Vatican appears to him, at any rate, as rushing into an agreement. So he himself is not happy. But of course, if an agreement is made, he will have to obey the Pope. Right? So I'm sure he's praying very hard that the Pope will be stopped.
I think Cardinal Zen is right. The Pope should proceed very cautiously and not sign on the dotted line until and unless he is happy that Beijing will keep to its end of the bargain, that they will not then move in the pretext that Vatican now recognizes China against the underground church. That's crucially important, because our experience with Beijing is that they will push and push and push. They will never let you know what they actually want until they know what your bottom line is. And Pope needs to stand very firm on the bottom line and not give way.
Thank you so much.
There's a lot of similarity between how the Catholic Church is run, how the communist government is run.
Oh, thank you so much for your wonderful presentation. I'm sure it's hugely educational for me, as well as for the audience. And thank you very much again for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.